From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caridi, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Monday, June 6, 2016. And on this day, authorities release the identity of a 7-year-old boy killed by a male pit bull as they try to determine what led to the attack. Maine voters will decide a record 5 citizen-initiated questions this November, part of a growing national trend of advocates taking their causes directly to voters. And we meet Republican primary candidate Mark Holbrook, who's vying for the GOP nomination in Maine's 1st congressional district. Those stories and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by Knack Factory, offering video production, photography, and communication strategy. knack-factory.com. And Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of Maine Public Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
I'm Barbara Caridi. Authorities have identified the 7-year-old boy who was fatally injured in a dog attack Saturday in Corinna. Penobscot County Sheriff Troy Morton says Hunter Bragg was pronounced dead at a Moody Mills Road residence after he was attacked by an adult male pit bull. The dog has been euthanized, but as A.J. Higgins reports, the investigation continues.
Many of the details in the death of Hunter Bragg are still being withheld. But Penobscot County Sheriff Troy Morton did finally reveal the breed of dog that police say was involved.
Hunter Bragg, a 7-year-old from Bangor, was pronounced deceased after being attacked by an adult male pit bull.
Morton says the attack occurred around 5:15 p.m. Saturday at a home in Corinna while the boy and his father were visiting friends.
Hunter was playing in the yard with 2 other children when he was attacked. Hunter's father, Jason Bragg, 35, was in the residence at the time of the attack. The owner of the dog, Gary Merchant, 45, of Corinna, was also at the residence. Following the attack, the owner requested the dog be euthanized by an area veterinarian. No other people were injured during this event.
According to WCSH-TV in Portland, a person claiming to be the previous owner of the dog and the victim's cousin told the station that the pit bull dog was not dangerous or vicious. The former owner said the animal had never shown signs of being aggressive and that he was a, quote, good and loving dog. Sheriff Morton says details about whether the dog had ever attacked anyone before or was tethered at the time of the incident are being withheld pending the results of his department's investigation.
And this is a sensitive and complex investigation, and some of those matters are best kept as we continue to investigate it. It's active investigation. As you know, some of the investigations and reports from the ME's office and veterinarian, things like that, are going to take days, if not weeks. So we'll continue to be able to release information when we can.
A site on GoFundMe.com has been set up to help Hunter Bragg's family pay for funeral expenses. Fatal dog attacks are rare in Maine, but in 2011, a 7-month-old girl in Frankfort, Annabelle Mitchell, was mauled to death by the family's Rottweiler. Her mother was sentenced to 3 months in jail for endangering the welfare of a child. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
Meanwhile, across the border in New Hampshire, authorities are investigating a fire that killed 4 people this morning. Firefighters say 2 adults and 2 children who died in the blaze were all living in the same apartment unit. Firefighters say they rescued a total of 30 people from the building. They say none of the 7 apartment units that were occupied are now livable. In November, Maine voters will decide a record 5 different citizen-initiated ballot questions when they go to the polls. The spike in ballot questions follows a national trend of politically active interest groups taking their causes directly to voters after they fail to get results in their legislatures. Steve Missler reports.
Thank you. Thank you, Maine.
When Governor Paul LePage won a second term 2 years ago, Ben Chin knew that his political strategy would have to change.
So after the election, we knew we were going to have at least 4 more years of divided government. And to do anything big, we were probably going to have to go to the ballot.
Chin is the political director for the Maine People's Alliance, just one of several progressive organizations that reevaluated its plans after the 2014 election. LePage had won despite expensive and vigorous opposition campaigns by groups like the MPA. Also, Republicans made significant gains in the state legislature, taking back control of the Senate. So groups like the MPA had two choices: fight a noisy, but likely futile, battle in the divided legislature, or, says Chin, use the state's 106-year-old citizen initiative process to take the case directly to voters. It became an easy decision.
Very quickly, it came back from them that raising the minimum wage was the top priority for what they felt like would be the biggest, most transformative thing that we could do.
Other groups have followed suit. A group backed by billionaire Michael Bloomberg is campaigning to enhance background checks on gun sales. The Maine Education Association is pushing a ballot question to increase education funding with a surcharge on families earning more than $200,000 a year. Another group wants to overhaul how elections are decided, and yet another organization wants to legalize marijuana. And there could have been more.
This year, we processed six initiatives, five of which qualified for the ballot for November. So five is our high watermark for a citizen initiative.
Secretary of State Matt Dunlap says there have been two other years when Maine voters have decided four ballot questions in a single election, but usually it's only one or two. And the spike in Maine comes after a 2014 election in which the number of ballot initiatives nationally was the lowest in 26 years. Those numbers are climbing this year, in part because voter turnout was so low in 2014 that it made it easier for activists to qualify their measures for the ballot this year. But Maine saw a very high turnout in 2014, and so was one of just three states where the bar was actually raised. So what's going on?
Well, you know, you might sort of have the perfect storm going on in Maine.
Jenny Bowser is a former senior fellow for the National Conference of State Legislatures, where she studied the history and use of ballot initiatives. She says an initiative is often a response to the actions or inactions of a state legislature. When a state house doesn't line up with the perceived wishes of a state's population, the citizen initiative is used to circumvent it. Of course, there are some issues that lawmakers just don't want to deal with, like gun control and marijuana legalization. And then there's the fact that legislatures are increasingly resembling Congress. More partisan fights, more gridlock. But it's not always safe to assume that a ballot initiative represents some sort of popular revolt, Bowser says.
People realized there was money to be made in the initiative process, and now there's this whole industry surrounding the initiative.
The industry includes campaign consultants, signature gatherers, pollsters, spokespeople, and advertising budgets. It all costs money, and people who do the campaign work don't do it cheaply. In 2009, a single political action committee spent $4.5 million to overturn the state's same-sex marriage law. 2 years ago, an out-of-state group seeking to ban bear hunting with traps and bait spent $2.5 million. And this year, a gambling impresario spent over $2.6 million just trying to get on this year's ballot. And most of that money went just to pay petition circulators.
This is a year where things are, I guess I would say overall it might be slightly more progressive than in years past, but not overwhelmingly.
Craig Burnett is a political science professor at Hofstra University. He says this year's ballot questions lean left. Maine is one of at least three states, for example, where voters will be asked to increase the minimum wage. Two other states will consider stronger background checks and marijuana legalization. If it seems like ballot questions are leaning left nationally, it could be because Republicans have seized control of state legislatures. Currently, Republicans control 60% of the country's state legislatures, while Maine is among the 14% in which power is split. That's a big swing from just 7 years ago, when Democrats controlled more than half of state houses. Rick Bennett, chairman of the Maine Republican Party, says he's not surprised that liberal interest groups have taken their cause to the voters. He says Republicans are ascendant in Maine and elsewhere. Also, it's easy to get on the ballot here, and running a campaign in Maine is relatively cheap.
You can run a referendum effort for just $1 million or $2, which, you know, to a group like the Bloomberg organization isn't a lot. Then, you know, maybe they can get a toehold here on a particular issue that they'd like to bring to other states in the future.
Even in 2014, when the number of ballot questions was low, corporations, interest groups, and wealthy individuals spent over $420 million nationwide on referendums, according to data collected by the Institute of Money and State Politics. National partisan organizations have sprouted to help channel this flow of cash. One of them, the Center for Conservative Initiatives, is an offshoot of the organization that typically funds Republican legislative campaigns. In fact, some observers believe that ballot measures can be used to drive voter turnout in favor of a certain candidate or party.
The danger you run is that it actually generates energy on your opponent's side.
Secretary of State Matt Dunlap cautions against the idea that ballot campaigns are essentially surrogates for political parties. In some instances, an issue that appears to align with a candidate could pose a problem. Dunlap cites two separate efforts several years ago to install a so-called taxpayer bill of rights. Both campaigns were run by conservative groups. Both spurred stiff opposition, and both were soundly defeated. And so were Republican hopes to gain majorities in the legislature. Beyond the trends, the financial motives, and the partisan maneuvering, the ballot process has a basic appeal to people like Ben Chin of the Maine People's Alliance.
The more that we can just get the public organized behind these like very simple questions that I think are common sense for most folks and will vastly improve people's lives, the more change that we can make directly. And we have this tool in Maine, so why not use it?
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Down in Washington, Maine U.S. Senator Susan Collins is taking issue with her party's presumptive presidential nominee, Donald Trump, over his comments about the judge overseeing lawsuits against Trump University. Collins says she was watching one of the TV news shows on Sunday when Trump said U.S. District Judge Gonzalo Curiel can't be impartial in the case because he's of Mexican heritage. Collins says Trump's comments crossed a line.
They demonstrate both the lack of respect for the judicial system and for the principle of separation of powers that is enshrined in our Constitution.
Meanwhile, Collins is asking the five makers of the overdose drug naloxone, also known as Narcan, to explain the reason for big price hikes on the life-saving drugs. Collins, the chair of the Senate Aging Committee, and ranking Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri have written a letter to the drug manufacturers asking them to explain the steep increases.
I can't rule out that it's an attempt to just make a lot of money on a drug that is desperately needed and that we want to put in the hands of first responders.
In one case, the price of naloxone, used to reverse the effect of an opioid overdose, has increased 17-fold. Collins says that's unacceptable as Congress and the states seek to make the drug more available to counter drug overdoses. Coming up, we meet one Republican candidate who hopes to win a seat in Congress, the first district House seat currently held by Democrat Shelley Pingree. A week from tomorrow, Republican voters in Maine's 1st Congressional District will decide between two candidates who are vying for the right to take on incumbent Democrat Shelley Pingree in the fall. In the first of two profiles we'll bring you this week, Mal Leary follows candidate Mark Holbrook, who believes he's the more conservative choice in the race.
Mark Holbrook, I'm running for Congress, John.
Pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure.
Mark Holbrook's been campaigning for the GOP nomination for over a year, meeting voters one-on-one and in small groups at local Republican gatherings. He's a clinical psychologist who's also been a police officer, worked on a commercial fishing vessel, and has been an instructor for the National Rifle Association Gun Safety Program. He's married with a daughter and has a distinct philosophy of government, which he shared with the audience at the Republican State Convention.
The American economy has stagnated because the liberals have placed a target on the backs of the middle class. Obama is bankrupting our nation. We're $19 trillion in debt.
And he's not just a fiscal conservative. He falls to the right on national security, repeal of the Affordable Care Act, and reducing taxes. He's critical of President Obama and incumbent Democratic Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, who he says wants to raise taxes.
Obama and Maine's progressive rubber stamp in Congress demand that 2% of our wage earners, who are already paying over half the taxes, by the way, aren't paying enough. And they want them to start paying their fair share. I think their socialist ideology is twisted and anti-American.
Holbrooke usually focuses his campaign message on how he plans to defeat Pingree. But when reminded he has to win the primary first, he portrays his Republican primary opponent, Andy Smith, as not conservative enough on some key issues.
You know, I'm very much pro-life, and he is not. I am very much for securing our borders with a fence or a wall or whatever is needed. He's not. I'm very much for keeping refugees out. He's not. He says we can let them in and we can vet them properly. I'm saying no, we can't.
Holbrooke says when voters in the first district are offered the option of a true conservative to challenge the liberal policies of Pingree, he will win. But some political scientists, including UMaine's Mark Brewer, question that assessment, at least in the state's traditionally progressive first district.
I think that the first congressional district in Maine is strongly Democratic, strongly liberal Democratic, an extremely safe Democratic district.
That opinion is shared by Colby College government professor Tony Corrado, who says the first district hasn't really changed that much.
Realistically, if we look at the voting patterns in the district, it's been the case that it's a strong Democratic district. Shelley Pingree is still well-liked in the district, and it will be a difficult district for the Republicans.
But Holbrooke believes he has a campaign plan to get his voters out to win the primary and then go forward to defeat Pingree. So far, Holbrooke's operating on a shoestring, raising less than $40,000, with about $10,000 of that from his own pocket. That contrasts with his opponent, Andy Smith, who's raised about $150,000 with about $20,000 of that his own money. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
And on Wednesday, we'll meet Holbrooke's primary opponent, Andy Smith. Meanwhile, a Democratic state lawmaker who has gained national prominence for supporting legalizing marijuana and eliminating superdelegates is flush with money from small out-of-state donors. Representative Diane Russell of Portland is running for the state Senate. From January through May, Russell raised nearly $87,000 for her campaign. The State Ethics Commission believes it's among the highest amounts ever raised for a Maine legislative primary. About 60% of Russell's donors gave $50 each or less, so their addresses don't need to be reported. Russell received more than $6,700 in itemized contributions from donors in California, which, like Maine, will consider a ballot initiative to legalize recreational marijuana this fall. Maine's Elver season wraps up tomorrow. Elvers are selling this year for about $1,450 a pound, and harvesters have until the close of business Tuesday to catch up to 361 pounds more of the baby eels. Many fishermen have already met their quotas of a little less than 10,000 pounds. Jeff Nichols is with the Maine Department of Marine Resources. He says he can't say for sure that the overall quota will be met.
I know we're going to come very close to being able to harvest the entire quota, very close to that, and that's a good thing for Maine harvesters.
Maine is the only state with a major elver fishery. The baby eels are exported to Asia, where they're raised to adulthood as food. Nichols says as of yesterday evening, fishermen have caught more than $13 million worth of elvers. He says that's already more than last year. Meanwhile, a Maine-based apparel company, started by the founders of Tom's of Maine, plans to open several retail locations in the coming months. Tom and Kate Chapel are looking for space to house a Rambler's Way farm store in Portland, as well as in Portsmouth and Hanover, New Hampshire, the Portland Press-Herald reports. Rambler's Way, based in the southern Maine town of Kennebunk, manufactures high-quality wool and cotton garments that are made in the USA, except for the occasional button or zipper. The company was founded by the Chapels in 2009, about 3 years after they sold their 84% stake in Tom's of Maine to Colgate-Palmolive Company for $100 million. And in Bath, the Maine Maritime Museum has won a $50,000 grant to help fund a new exhibit designed to let visitors experience what it was like to be in the tower room of the Two Lights Lighthouse in Cape Elizabeth. Museum Executive Director Amy Lent says the full-scale replication will include time-lapsed video projections and feature a panorama of the Gulf of Maine that will change with the seasons and the weather,
along with the wind and the sounds that you would hear. So it's creating a way for people who are never have been up to the top of the lighthouse or are not going to be able to, for accessibility reasons, be at the top of a lighthouse, that kind of experience.
Lent says the $50,000 grant is part of a $1 million fundraising effort to create the lighthouse exhibit. She says the museum has already raised nearly $700,000 and plans to open the exhibit next summer. Included in it is the actual Fresnel lens from Two Lights. And finally, here's meteorologist Paul Cousins with the forecast.
Drier air has purged much of the cloudiness from southern and central counties and will eventually rid the mountains and northeastern Maine of any lingering showers and thunderstorms this evening. Some clouds will turn southwest late, valley fog, low 50s north, low 60s south. Tomorrow will be our final warm day prior to a pattern shift. Over northern and down east Maine, a bit of sun early, afternoon showers and isolated afternoon thunder. It will be mostly cloudy throughout the remainder of the state with showers by midday and afternoon thunderstorms, some sufficiently robust to spew out some damaging gusts. Low 70s north, near 80 interior south. It will be notably cooler and breezy for the rest of the week. Wednesday, mostly cloudy with scattered showers north and west, mix of sun and clouds for the rest of the state, 60 to 69 north to south. Thursday will be the coolest day of the week, 50s along the northwest border, 60s for most, cloudy with showers north, considerable cloudiness south. Friday, perhaps dry for all and not quite as cool. This is meteorologist Paul Cousins for Maine Public Broadcasting.
And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Monday, June 6, 2016. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall, Susan Sharon, and Andrew Catalina. And to A.J. Higgins, Mal Leary, Steve Missler, Nora Flaherty, and Ed Morin for their contributions. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the podcast. You can rate and comment in iTunes, or you can email us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caritti. For all of us here at Maine Public Broadcasting, thanks for listening.